In this special episode of Agents of Data, we caught up with Eduardo Ordax, Gen AI Lead at AWS. We dig into the foundational role of data, its success in AI, the democratization, and the practical applications of Gen AI and the evolution towards autonomous agents. We also discover what he learned from Jeff Bezos and why collaboration is going to be so important as we move closer to an agentic future. With that, I'll hand over to Ian Fennell. Ian, take it away.
Great. Thank you so much for joining, Eduardo. Eduardo Ordax is the EMEA AI lead at AWS, having spent more than 15 years at the heart of tech and specializing in artificial intelligence and machine learning. Eduardo helps organizations accelerate their digital transformation and fully exploit the potential of these disruptive technologies. Eduardo balances technical expertise with commercial acumen, supporting organizations as they navigate the ever-changing AI landscape, but always maintaining a focus on strong data foundations. His guiding principle is to give anything less than your best is to sacrifice the gift. So I know today's conversation is going to be a blast. So welcome, Eduardo. My name is Ian Fennell. I'm a data engineering advocate lead at Matillion. And I'm looking forward to talking to you about data and AI.
Thanks a lot.
Awesome. Let's dive in. Should we start? Just tell us a little bit, Eduardo, about your career journey so far and how that led and how that got you into AI and machine learning.
Well, you explain it, to be honest, much better than me. I think like I'm going just to copy and paste the description and put it around, right? So I have a technical background, right? I'm a computer scientist. I've been coding at, you know, the beginning of my life, C++, Java, all the stuff. But the reality is like very soon I move into, you know, like sales, business development and so on. I think it's because, you know, like how I am, and I always like to be, you know, like in touch with people, having this kind of, you know, like relationships, but also always very close to, you know, like tech and so on. And the reality is like, it was a day like 8, 9 years ago. I remember, you know, like seeing a description for a postgraduate program about, you know, like data science. And I found it super, you know, like interesting. But at that time, you know, like data science, it was not what it is today. And I thought that it was like a good time, a right time, you know, like to upskill myself, to try to, you know, like come back to my origins, to my roots. And then, you know, like you start doing something that takes you to the next step and then to the next step and then to the next step. And this is where, you know, like I land into AWS, working for the last 8, 7 years, you know, like on data and AI. At the beginning, it was like mainly data and AI, mainly data and analytics, mainly data, actually. Right now, it seems like everything is AI. That's why I always say like, hey, you need to be focused on data. And yeah, this is me actually having a lot of fun for the last 3 years working at AWS. I think it's an amazing, you know, like a place to be if you want to do things, if you want to meet people, if you want to be, you know, like on the latest technology that it's happening around the world. So yeah, that's me.
Awesome. I think we'll find ourselves agreeing a fair amount on the role that data has to play to back up AI. I'm curious, before we dive into that, so you call yourself an enthusiast rather than an expert. Why is that?
Well, actually, I prefer to say an outsider rather than being an expert, right? And it's because, you know, like, and I don't have anything wrong with the expert concept, right? But I think in today's world, we have misused a lot this word, because it seems like, you know, like everyone seems to be an expert. Like, hey, you know, like you are talking about the tariffs. Hey, you are an expert on tariffs. You are talking about, you know, like the succession of the Pope. Hey, you are an expert on, you know, like on the Vatican. And it's always the same story, right? So I think, you know, like sometimes even when you call yourself an expert, it's going to be seen in the wrong way, right? And also because an expert, I think there is like very few experts in the world, right? I mean, like being an expert, when I'm talking to people, I realize how less I know, because I'm always learning from others, right? So I don't like to say I'm an expert, because I try to learn almost every day. And I know it's not even possible, right? Like there is always, you know, like bunch of stuff that you can always learn and so on. I'm an enthusiast because to be honest, for me, AI, I always say the same thing. It's more than a work, it's a passion. I really enjoy doing what I'm doing today, meeting people, talking about something that, you know, like it's hard to make the difference between, you know, like work and life. That's why I prefer to say like, hey, I'm an enthusiast, I'm an outsider, because always I have like kind of a different point of view in some aspects. I don't think I like to make noise, but you know, like I'm a bit, you know, like a critic with some stuff. That's why I never call myself an expert, to be honest.
Oh, that's fantastic to hear. I completely get your point. If the industry is moving so fast, things are changing all the time, it's kind of not really possible to actually be an expert. I agree with your point there. And in order to keep up with all the changes that are happening all the time, you have to be passionate about a subject, or else you just wouldn't have the time to do it.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
Amazing to hear. Yeah, I'm interested in the journey that you've seen at AWS, moving from data towards AI, in the time that you've experienced it. What would you do? Just talk to us a little bit about that journey, if you could. What's it involved? Where's it going? How do they relate to each other, the data and the AI?
Yeah, sure. I remember, you know, when I joined AWS 3 years ago, I remember, you know, I watching different videos about, you know, like Jeff Bezos. By that time, like almost 20 years ago, he used to say, like, you know, like our most valuable asset right now, it's data, because we know data from our customers, we know what they want, we know what they like, we know their interest, and this is, you know, like a lot of potential for us, because we can, you know, like make the right recommendations to our customers. And even Jeff, by that time, always said like, hey, we are a data company. And I'm talking about 20 years ago, that it's such a long time, right? And we have been using data for a lot. I mean, like if you think about our marketplace, everything is based on data. We know, like, you know, like which is the most suitable product for you. We know, like, when people is going to buy this product or the other product, and at the end, you know, like AI is just a consequence of data. I mean, like, you cannot do AI if you really have like a data foundation. So I think you're like, and even the first service at AWS, it was like S3, right? That is nothing else than, you know, like a place to store data, and then we have, you know, like all these databases, RepSeed. Actually, even I think like Aurora, that is, you know, like our relational database, it was the product that it grew faster in the history of AWS, right? So I think that's why I say like AWS has invested a lot on data, but also trying to find a way to monetize that data. And one way is by using, you know, like AI, how to make good recommendations, how to make sure our, you know, like fulfillment centers, they are going to deliver on time to the right user in the right moment, and so on and so forth. Or even, you know, like for demand forecasting, like, hey, we know, like, you know, like it's summer is getting closer, and you know, like people is going to buy more about this specific product. Everything is driven by, you know, like AI, ML, and so on. That's why I think, you know, like we always, you know, like find the right relationship between data and AI. And I think we try to do the same thing with our customers. Very often, you know, like people ask to me like, hey, what do you need to be, you know, like successful with AI? And it's like, hey, maybe you are making the wrong question. It's like, what do you need to be successful with data? Because just being successful with AI is going to be just a consequence if you are successful with data, that, right? First. So I think that's, you know, like pretty much the story that we have lived at AWS. Well, actually at Amazon in general, that we try, you know, to replicate across our customers.
Awesome. Now that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, you just can't do AI unless you have that solid foundation of data, and those services, the original ones like S3, and the number of different database services that you have now, they were foundational at the beginning, and they're still foundational now. Just more services have come on top of those.
Awesome. Yeah, absolutely.
Can we talk for a minute? Then let's dive into some details about the domain. Talk to us about generative AI in particular. where it fits into the grand scheme of things. What's different about it? What's different than from what came before?
Well, I think with Unreka, the biggest difference with generative AI is that it took the attention for almost everyone. And, you know, like, especially when you have been working in this space for so many time, right? And I always put the same example. I used to talk to my friends and they didn't have like quite good idea about what I was doing for a living. Yeah, they knew that I was working at AWS, but hey, can you explain me what I'm doing or what I'm, you know, like, doing for a living? And they didn't have like an idea. And generative AI, you know, like, since the release of ChatGPT, really, you know, like, took the attention from almost everyone because it was like super disruptive for many different reasons, right? So I always say, like, at the end of the day, generative AI, it's not nothing new, right? I mean, like, Transformers has been there for such a long time. I think it was released in 2018 or 17. So it's not new, right? But at the end of the day, you know, like, with artificial intelligence in general, we have never found like a real use case for, you know, like almost everyone, like, hey, where you can use it for, you know, like for your daily life that is going to be useful, that is going to provide you, an add value, right? And generative AI, has achieved that, right? So it's not nothing new. I mean, like, it's just, deep neural networks, transformers. I always say, like, hey, you have AI, within AI, you have machine learning, within machine learning, you have deep learning, and then you have transformers. So it's just, you know, like a subset of AI, right? But generative AI, because you're like, and the own meaning of generative AI that it says, like, it's about generating content, right? It can be applied for many different use cases. And I think that's one of the greatest things of generative AI. Like in the past, if you are using, you know, like ML, yeah, you could, you know, like train a model to, I don't know, detect customer fraud or to detect churn or to do customer segmentation. But it was like very narrow scope. Right now with generative AI, it's completely different thing. I mean, like, I was reading a report couple of days ago about how people is using generative AI. And what surprised me the most, it was about, hey, trying to find a purpose on life, trying to understand how things are happening around them. It was not even for business. It was even for, you know, like, personal stuff, right? I mean, like, hey, I need to cook something today. I have these ingredients of my fridge and I want to use it for that. So, I mean, like, it finally has democratized the access to AI in general. I think that's the greatest thing, because I used to say, like, AI in general, it was always was the false promise. Like, hey, it's something that has a lot of potential. It's going to be there. It's going to be used. But still, you know, like, it was not, you know, like, being able to take off, right? And right now, we are seeing a different reality. Like, everyone is using generative AI in one way or the other, even for business, for personal use, across every single part of the world. And I think that's amazing.
Fantastic. Yeah, that really, to play that back, you've talked about how it's just very easy to understand what it does, because anybody can use generative AI. It's not it's democratized, indeed, I think is a great word, and it's easy to understand. You just ask it a question and it gives you a reply. Obviously, why it's receiving so much popular attention right now. I'm curious for your thoughts on how generative AI can be put to use in industry, because you can. One of the modern ironies is that if you want to know what the weather is, it's quicker to look on your phone or ask a generative AI what the weather is. It's quicker to do that than to stick your hand out the window. But what about industry? You know, in terms of what use cases can be done with generative AI?
Yeah, you know, something that I've seen for the last couple of years, or in the last 18 months, that, you know, like, surprised me the most. I remember like 3, 4, 5 years ago, talking to customers. And they were struggling to identify use cases. I mean, like, they were not fully aware about AI or ML. And it's like, hey, how can I use ML to be more productive, right? What I'm seeing right now, it's completely different. You go to customers and they say to you, like, hey, I have these 15 different use cases that I want to implement. Can you help me to develop the use cases? Can you help me to prioritize the use cases? Can you help me to deploy the use cases? But they have like a pretty good idea about how they can use generative AI across these different, you know, like business cases or industries. Of course, there are some, you know, like sectors that they are, you know, like more suitable to start using generative AI. I mean, like if you talk about, you know, like finance, retail, everything related to customer support. I mean, like it's pretty straightforward, right? Because I always say the same thing, like you have like cross use cases and vertical use cases. If we talk about cross use cases, most of the customers, they are doing like the same thing in these three main different areas, right? So first, it's about, you know, like enhancing customer experience. I mean, like how we can improve the experience of our customers. And this is, you know, like typical virtual assistants, chatbots, and so on, that we all know, like, chatbots has been there for such a long time, but they were like a bit of crap, right? I mean, like you were trying to talk to the chatbots, they were not never able to give you the right answer, and at the end, you always need to go through a real agent, right? Right now, it's a different story, and right now, it's working pretty well. So, it's customer experience is the first thing. Second is about productivity, and by productivity, I see like two main use cases. First is about, you know, like writing code. I think like, if you take any role in the world right now and you ask like, hey, which is the role that has changed the most in the last couple of years, is for software developers. And by software developers, I put there like everyone, ML engineers, software engineers, AI engineers, data scientists, backend, frontend, whatever. Because you can use LLMs. LLMs in the past, right now, it's more about, you know, like agents, right? Developer agents. To boost the way you are writing code. It's not about, you know, like, making suggestions to the code. It's about, you know, like, writing documentation. It's about running the tests. It's about, monitoring and observability. So I think this is the, probably the top one use case across every single industry, because it's very simple to implement in some way or the other, right? So I think every customer right now that they have developers, they have builders in their teams, they are using generative AI in one way or the other. And for business users, in terms of productivity, is RAG. And I'm talking about retrieval augmented generation as a wider concept, right? Because we know it's, you know, like it can be seen as, you know, like a mechanism to augment the knowledge of the LLMs. But at the end of the day, you know, like every company, they have data, and most of the times they struggle to find the right information within those huge amount of data. And by implementing RAG at scale, you can say like, hey, I want to search for something specific, or I want to get some insights from here. So almost every single customer right now that I've seen is trying to implement RAG in one flavor or the other, but it's doing something similar to RAG. And this year, 2025, it's like agents almost everywhere. And agents for me, it's automation, right? It's like, LLMs are useful, but still you need to do like a lot of manual work. Like, hey, I'm going to give you this prompt. You are going to retrieve this information. Then I'm going to write another prompt. I'm going to call this function. And it's like a lot of, you know, like iterative process. It's still very manual. But with agents, it's a different story, because you can automate this end-to-end, right? And I think this is where, you know, like it leaves all the value that, you know, generative AI can bring in the future. I don't think, and sometimes, you know, like I have this big discussion in my own head, like, hey, where the future is going on? It's about, you know, like finding more intelligent systems, or it's about, you know, like automation. And I think it's about, at the end, it's about automation. We don't need to have like super intelligent systems, but we need to automate things, because this is where, you know, like the value is going to come, right? So I see right now most and more customers like, you know, like automating different processes, mainly internal processes, workflows. Like it's like, hey, it's being super complicated. Let's say like I need to register a new article, and the process to register a new article, you have to digitalize something, then you need to open your CRM, then you need to send, I don't know, whatever, to another place. And I think, you know, they are trying to use agents for all these processes, and I think there is a lot of value. Actually, it was not me, it was Gartner, that probably they know much more than me, but they were saying like, you know, like by 2028, I think it was around, you know, like 30% of the business processes, they are going to be run in one way or the other by, you know, like AI and AI agents. And I think it could be potentially even more. So I think this is where, you know, like we are going right now.
Fantastic. There's so much detail there. I was making a few notes as you were speaking. You were broadly talking, correct me if I've got this wrong, but you were broadly, we were talking about how industry can take advantage of generative AI. It seems to me you had split it into two, talking about using AI on your data, for example, with chatbots and RAG. I'd like to come back to RAG in a moment, actually. And then secondly, you were talking about using AI and agents. I'd like to come back to agents in a moment as well, in terms of productivity, like software generation, helping with coding and all those kind of things, and automating the simple things, because it seems that so much time is spent doing kind of repetitive and maybe quite dull work that actually we'd all be better off if that kind of stuff was automated and would free up the humans to do the more interesting things. Is that a fair summary?
Yeah, it's fair. I mean, like, in a very short manner, we could say, like, one pillar is customer experience, improving customer experience. Second pillar is, you know, like, boosting productivity, where you have RAG, writing code. And third pillar, it's automation. That in some manner, automation is also part of, you know, like, productivity. But I used to talk most of the times about these three main pillars.
Gotcha. That makes sense. Awesome. So, kind of underpinning the certainly the chatbot and the RAG to a really great degree is data. I'm a data person, so I really strongly related to your story of how data underpins AI. It strikes me that that if you're implementing a chatbot, for example, or if you're implementing a RAG solution, you need really good quality data to make that work. Otherwise, it's not going to help. It's not going to help people, and it might even give them incorrect advice, which wouldn't be good at all. Is that fair to say, do you think?
It's super fair to say. Actually, I've seen customers, you know, complaining because, okay, the model, you know, like, it's giving me the wrong answer all the time. Actually, the problem was not in the model, but it was on the data. For example, in this case, it was like, hey, it was not synchronized in real time. So even, you know, working with generative AI, they had this kind of, you know, like, data drift, because, you know, like, they were collecting data that it was, you know, like, being converted into embeddings, like, overnight. So they were not, like, the last, because you were talking about having cleaning data. I always say that also, you know, like, having data on time, updated data, right? Because you need to use the latest data, for example, to run your customer service chatbot or whatever. So I think it's very fair. Sometimes we focus too much on, you know, like, the model itself. And the problem, it may be in our side, like, hey, do we have the right data to implement the use case? Because at the end, you know, like, generative AI, it's kind of, you know, like, a dumb, in the way that, you know, like, if you have two customers, both of them are using the same model with the same inputs because they are not really leveraging their own data, they're going to get the same output. So does not provide any value. I think the value is when you use these models with your data that needs to be clean, needs to be updated, needs to be on time, needs to be unbiased, needs to be clear, needs to be all these things.
Gotcha. Yeah. So the sweet spot for industry then is where great data intersects with great usage of the correct or the latest LLM technology.
Yeah.
Awesome. That makes sense. I'm aware that we were talking about RAG a few minutes ago. We were talking about embeddings and document sources and those kind of things. Just help me out a little bit. Just explain a little bit some of those terms, if you wouldn't mind, because a lot of this stuff is so new that it's so easy to get lost in all the jargon. Just if you wouldn't mind.
Yeah, you know, like, for me, the perfect definition for RAG, I always use the same definition, right? It's like going to the exam, you are the LLM, you are the large language model, and you don't know the answer for every single question, right? And the teacher says to you, like, hey, it's not a problem. If you don't know the question, you can go, you can open the book, you can try to, you know, like, read the answer on the book, and then you augment your, you know, like, reply on the exam, right? And it seems like, okay, RAG is super simple. If I don't know the answer, I'm going to have access to external sources. It may be a database, it may be documents, it may be tools. I find the right answer there and I augment my reply. The main problem with RAG is sometimes the answer is not in a single book. It's across many different books within thousands of different books. So it's not the same thing to find the right answer into a book that you have like 20,000 books. And even some of them, they have exactly the same name, but they change some, you know, like a minimal stuff, right? So at the end of the day, you know, like RAG is about how you can, you know, like find these right parts of, you know, like of knowledge that is not within the model, that you are going to provide like a consistent answer. And I'm talking consistent answer because even still with, I used to hear like, hey, RAG is going to eradicate any hallucination on the LLMs. And actually it's not, because even if you retrieve, if you recover the wrong part of the document or whatever, you still have, you know, like an answer that is going to be like an hallucination. So for me, this is RAG. And then we can discuss about, okay, yeah, you need to convert, you know, like the words into embeddings because this is the way that, you know, like models talk to the documents. You can talk about, you know, like advanced techniques to retrieve the right parts of the documents because, as I have said before, like if you need to find across, I don't know, 20,000 books, maybe, you know, like trying to search book by book is not going to be efficient because it's going to take a lot of time, it's going to take a lot of effort, it's going to take a lot of money. And there are like different techniques that they are going to help you to find faster and also cheaper, right?
Gotcha, yeah. I was thinking how my exams might have been different in the past if I had access to the book like you described. That would have been different. But actually, it's not exactly like that, is it? Because, as you said, it's as if you were being asked a question, but you were in a library, and your first job is to go and find the right book in the library, and that's where organizing your data, I think, is going to be important, and things like the embedding, which is the way that you encode so that the machine can understand what it's reading out of the books. Because the ultimate goal is to, like you said, to avoid hallucinations, and that is when the LLM produces what sounds like a good answer, but actually is completely wrong.
Actually, it's not. Yeah.
It's not the right answer at all. Interesting insight that that RAG does not eliminate hallucinations entirely, because there are many vectors for failure. There are many things that could go wrong. If you think about all the moving parts with this, what can you give any thoughts or advice on minimizing that kind of thing? People talk about keeping humans in the loop, all those kind of things.
So what I've seen about RAG, especially, you know, like when people say like, hey, do you have any tip or trick to make sure like, you know, like your solution is going to work fine? I always say the same thing, like, you know, like with RAG, you cannot test with probably, you know, like 5 or 10% of your, you know, like your documents or your databases or your source of information. You need to be super close to what is going to be in a real scenario. So if you say you're going to have in, you know, like in the deployment state, I don't know, 1,000 different documents, let's try to do all the testing with maybe not the 1,000, but maybe at least, you know, like half of them. Because, you know, like, RAG is getting super complicated as soon as you scale on the number of, you know, like information and documentation and so on. Right. This is the first thing. The second aspect is sometimes, you know, like it's not important the model that you are using, but how you are structuring the information. And you know, like talking about techniques like chunking, because you cannot convert your documents like, hey, I have my documents there and it's fine. You need to convert your documents like in small pieces, because when you are trying to find the answer, your answer is like a very small piece, right? So you need to convert first this, you know, like a document into small pieces. And there are like many different ways, right? Like you can say like, okay, I have, you know, like a lot of pieces from the same size. So I'm going to have like semantic pieces, right? Like I do these semantic chunks, or I do like, so the way you build these chunks or the way you cut all these different, you know, like small pieces from the documents, sometimes it's even more important than, you know, like the real retrieval process itself. And the next suggestions that I will make is during, you know, like the experimentation part, or during, you know, like the time you are building your RAG solution, try to experiment a lot with different techniques, because there are a lot. And right now that we have agents, I think it's pretty great, because, you know, at the same time, you can use different techniques. You have this, for example, hybrid search, where you can find from somewhere, you can find based on, you know, like a semantic search. And on the other is like keyword matching, right? So for some use cases, trying to find the semantic approach is going to work well, while in the others is going to be like more keyword matching, or trying to rewrite the question from the user, because we assume that the user is going to make the right question, but actually it's not actually making the right question. So you need to rewrite the questions, right? So there are many techniques. My suggestion is to try to see which one fits better with the different use cases, because this is going to improve a lot, you know, like the final result. Again, RAG, it can be super simple. It can be super complex. I mean, like if you are building a customer support chatbot and you have a manual or a tutorial with 50 pages, piece of cake. It's super easy. It's end of story. Maybe you don't need to do like a nothing more, right? But as soon as you scale, you need to do a lot of experimentation, a lot of testing, and trying to test with, you know, like the most amount of information that it's possible, trying to build a right strategy about your vector database, right? You are going to store these documents into a vector database, right? So it's also super important how you define the strategy about, like the same way you defined a strategy about your data, how you are storing your data, who is going to govern your data, who is your data steward, who is whatever. It's the same thing with a vector database. Trying to define the strategy is going to help a lot in the implementation phases.
Oh, wow. Fantastic. I was just thinking just how many moving parts there are that you have to manage when you're trying to do something like RAG. Fascinating list of things to check there, because people would think, oh yeah, I've got my documents, I've got my LLM, I've chunked it up, all good, nothing else I can do. But actually, it's not the case at all. You need to test very thoroughly all the different use cases to vary the way that you chunk. That means to split up the document in different ways. That's a fascinating insight. To not only rely on vector search and embedding search, just good old fashioned keyword searching,
yeah,
it might well be sufficient if you've got a question that's, you know, got a very specific keyword in it. And I love the idea about simply rewriting the question as well. That's if the question isn't clear enough, then it's, you're not going to get a good answer, because it's just not clear what's being asked. Fascinating. Thanks for sharing those insights. That's really valuable. I suppose that kind of moves on fairly naturally to talking about or thinking about how an agent is implementing RAG. If it needs to decide, this question isn't very clear, maybe I should rewrite the question before going on to step two. That's kind of the architecture behind agentic AI, where you give the a bit more agency to the AI and let it decide. Could you talk for a minute about those kind of things, about agentic AI in particular, and again how that might advance things in its own way?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, with LLMs for the last couple of years, we have seen great evolution, but at the end of the day, you know, they were not like meaningful. That's what I'm saying. Like, yeah, you can, you know, like ask this AI assistants, like, I don't know, Claude, Gemini, ChatGPT, to make a summary of something, or to give you ideas for cooking, whatever, right? But eventually you need to take all these actions. So it's super manual. For me, you know, like the next steps is agents in the way that, okay, you have an LLM that it's improving the reasoning capabilities, because I think when people say like, okay, an agent, it's an LLM because it can take actions. Yeah, it's true, but it's not absolutely true. I mean, like, we have seen LLMs improving their reasoning capabilities. And by improving the reasoning capabilities, like, they can take a problem and they can break it into small pieces and trying to, you know, like, face every single piece. I remember at the beginning with LLMs, as soon as you were putting like a bit more complex problem, like, even it's a very simple problem for a maybe 10 years old kid, but still it was like super complicated for an LLM. It has improved a lot, and you can put like real complex stuff so they can break it. And the next thing is like, they can plan. And we know, like, maybe LLMs, they are not like super good at planning, but they are becoming better and better on that, right? So agencies, when you have this LLM, this large language model, that, okay, it has improved in reasoning capabilities, so they break the problem into small pieces, they make a plan about how to, you know, like, face this initial problem, and then they have a suite of different tools to take the actions. Like, okay, you can make a call to a database and retrieve the part, or you can connect to an MCP server or just to an API. You were asking before about what's the weather in, I don't know, in London for next week. Yeah, you are not going to ask an LLM, but the LLM eventually, they can make a call to weather forecast. They make a call to the API, they retrieve the information and give it to you, right? So when you allow these models to take actions, when they have, you know, capabilities to reason, to make a plan, and also when they are able to keep a memory about, you know, like the previous interactions, like more like a long-term memory about, I always put the same example, right? If I'm traveling a lot, right? And I'm always traveling with the same airline. I'm from Spain, so I'm traveling with Iberia. So when I'm calling my real agent, they know already that I want to travel with Iberia. So they don't want to ask me like, okay, which airline are you going to travel? So this is the same for an AI agent. I mean, like, if they already know that I'm traveling most of the times with Iberia, they don't know to make me the question. So they need to keep like a long-term memory. But the other aspect is also about this short-term memory. And this is one of the main problems with LLMs. I was saying before, like, they are not very good at planning. So if you have to do a task or to solve a problem that involves many different steps, at some point of time, they just get crazy and they don't know how to proceed, right? So you need to keep a certain memory about, okay, you have done already A, B, and C, so now you have to B, or you have to do D, right? So these are the kind of, you know, like, tools that give you or gives agents the capability to, you know, like, automate things, to be more autonomous. But still, I think we are still in the very early days, because most of the things that I've seen right now with customers, more than agents, it's workflows where, yeah, you have an LLM that take an action and then you implement business rules like, okay, the output of this is going to come here and the output from here is going to come again to the other place. But I think, you know, like, the difference is, like, agents, they are meaningful. They are meaningful because they don't need you to do the things. They are doing the things for you, right? And that's why I see a lot of evolution in the space, probably the next few years, to be honest.
Fascinating. Yeah. So there's a lot to dig into there. I was interested in the way that you talked about the difficulty that LLMs have understanding problems, because of course they're not really general intelligence. They are just very clever word completion algorithms. I was thinking of the Marx Brother film where the guy says, "Why a six-year-old child could understand this?" But actually, that's not the case at all. So I guess again, to try and summarize your description of it, the difference that agentic AI brings is that in addition to the context input, which is maybe a prompt or a document, if it was RAG, there's also some history and some personalization that's necessary. Again, realizing how important the bringing the right data is to that, and then an agentic AI agent can make a decision and then take an action as well. and maybe go in a loop and do that until some exit condition is met. But I completely get your point that if I've understood you correctly, it's fairly new and it's evolving because the technology is evolving to some great extent.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's fair to say that that people are working out how agentic AI can create value at the moment. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, and there's a lot of discussion as well, right? Because when you are talking about adding value, in some way or the other, people is talking about replacing people. And this is a very tough discussion because from one side, if you are automating things that before were executed or were driven by people, right now it seems like this is going to be replaced, right? So I think everyone is trying to search in that space how they can automate things to be more productive. And eventually it's like, okay, if the people they were spending huge amount of time on doing this, why not putting these people to do other stuff, right? But again, I think it's part of of this evolution that we need to transition into different responsibilities, different roles. What I think it's happening at the same time is you were saying at the beginning, right? The evolution pace is huge. So I think right now we are delivering much faster, better than a previous year ago because AI. So I think this is just accelerating this. So you can have people doing more with less. And yeah, but again, I think it's also a tough discussion that at some point of time, we will need to see how we are going to face it.
Interesting. Yeah, it's unprecedented. I think the pace of change that we're seeing, the amount of innovation that's coming. I feel lucky to be working in this industry at this time. Actually, it's such a fascinating time to be in this field. We're coming towards the end of the time we have allocated, so I guess there's a couple more things if I could ask you to talk about. First of all, it's partly because there is so much new technology, it's difficult to know where to get started or how to safely take your first steps into taking advantage of AI. There's clearly a lot of advantage to be had, but what advice would you give to data leaders who are looking to start integrating AI into their business? How to get started? How to even prove the value?
Yeah, so I think first of all it's about trying to understand these technologies, and you cannot just trying to be guided by the buzzwords like, hey, I want to be AI first, I want to be, and everyone is running and trying to build stuff with nonsense, right? So I think it's first about trying to understand the capability itself. You started great the conversation about, hey, what is generative AI? What are the main differences to AI to ML, whatever? So I think for everyone working on this space needs to start by the very beginning or the main foundations about, okay, what is AI, how it is based on, how you can use it, different use cases. So the more you learn how it works, the better it's going to be implemented, because maybe you want to do AI, but maybe your use case demands or requires to have explainability from the very beginning. And actually, generative AI is not the best approach because it lacks one of the most important aspects about explainability, right? So I think trying to understand the foundations. And I think right now it's super easy to get information over the internet. There are amazing courses, free courses everywhere, deep learning, different cloud providers. But also, don't make the mistake, because I've seen also people trying get information from LLMs at the same point, right? And as I said before, they tend to hallucinate a lot as well. So I remember it was like a joke, right? But I was talking to a friend that they were using, in this case, ChatGPT, to learn more about AI. And the truth is like, yeah, most of the answers, they were true or partially true, but there were like many others as well that were like just pure hallucinations, right? So I think it's important, like, yeah, it's, I mean, like I always say the same thing. It's like, okay, to ride a bike, to learn to ride a bike, you need to ride a bike. But to learn AI, of course, you need to do hands-on, but you need to make the difference about when to use it and when to don't use it to learn AI, right? But again, I think it's about, you know, understanding the foundations, and from there you can evolve almost wherever you want.
That, I love that story. That's fascinating. So yeah, just to check your reasoning if you're using using an LLM for that. But I get the main thing that you're saying is that people just need to understand what is possible, what's a good use case and what is not a good use case. Because interesting, you pointed out that this technology is inherently non-deterministic. If you run the same thing twice, you won't get the same answer. Hopefully you'll get something similar second time through.
Hopefully.
but you're not guaranteed. So there's always some element of uncertainty in there, which I guess that can be quite scary if you're used to a very precise process. If this is bigger than 0.5, then definitely do this. Otherwise, definitely do something else. That's kind of not the case anymore with the workflows with if you're introducing generative AI.
Correct.
Interesting. How would you, if you were a data leader or an AI leader, how would you start going about trying to prove the value or demonstrating value in a project?
Yeah, I think like two things here, right? I think everything is about trying to put the right team in place. Many customers, they are struggling right now because they don't have the right skills. They don't have the right people. And this is something that sometimes is not enough just with hiring people, because you need to train your team, right? So I would say for all your like data leaders, AI leaders, even your like any C-level, they have to invest on their teams, with upskilling, internal training, hiring as well, but they need to invest on this. And I think you need to put very close technology, IT, and business working together. Something that I've seen for the last couple of years, it's like many companies, they are transitioning the operating model. They used to have like very clear, you know, differentiation between, you know, like, IT or data, IT, and then the business. And now I see more and more, you know, like this kind of, you know, like a federated models where, you know, like both teams are working together. And I think that's the key thing, because I mean, like, as soon as, you know, like it's getting democratized, because at the end of the day, you know, like the use cases needs to come from the business, but then you have, you know, like the data teams, the AI teams who are going to implement these use cases, but then they need to validate again with the business, right? So having this kind of cross-functional team, I think it's super important. So they need to break barriers. They need to work together, and they need to have like the right people. Because I don't think it's a problem about technology. I mean, like, technology, it's fine. Eventually, it's going to be there. I don't think it's a problem. Of course, maybe for some super specific use cases, maybe you don't have the right technology. But 99% of the times, I don't think it's a problem of technology. I think it's a problem of, you know, like, how you define the processes, how you put the people working together, and how to ensure you have the right skills.
Fantastic. Yeah, it's kind of reassuring to hear that at the end of the day, it's people are still important in this world of AI. It also makes me think with classic data warehousing, you could make the most brilliant technology in the world, but if it didn't answer the question that was coming from the business, then it was not a good solution.
Correct.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. Awesome. I would just have just one last question then for you, Eduardo. Think of some interesting or just inspiring use case that stands out for you just in 60 seconds, just something that's, that you really love about generative AI that you've maybe come across recently.
So I don't think it's like it's super disruptive, but I know you. I love how you know, like they are breaking barriers in some way, right? So this is a customer. Well, it's a customer. It's a startup, right? It's also a customer. It's called CampAI. This is a startup based on Dubai, and they're in the UAE. They are like doing like amazing stuff right now, to be honest. So they are able, you know, like to translate in real time. Actually, you know, like do the transcriptions from real conversations in real time. So they used to say like, we are not like a, you know, like a company that is, you know, translating stuff, but we are a company that we are breaking barriers, because they were talking about, you know, like India, for example, that they have around, you know, like 7,000 different dialects. So right now they are able, you know, like to recreate the movies in the, you know, with the right or with the original voice at the right time in the right minute. So they were, you know, like democratizing getting access to the knowledge. So I think this use case, it's simply amazing. I mean, like, it's not super disruptive, but this is, or they are doing like brilliant, because they are just focused on this specific path, right? They have multiple use cases for, you know, like, imagine about, you know, like sport broadcasting. Like, hey, you can watch the same football match in Spain, and then you have it translated, well, transcribed in many different languages with the same voice, everything's the same, but keeping the context. And I really love it because they are like this very, I mean, and I love it because these folks, they are from the UAE. They are just 10, 15 people, and they are doing like amazing stuff around the world. And this is because of AI. So I think in some manner, AI put us everyone in the same, you know, like a start line. And it's about, okay, who is going to bring, you know, the greatest ideas right now? So as you say, it's not about replacing people. It's about, you know, like boosting our capabilities. And I love this use case, but many others, like, you know, like small companies that they are doing like amazing stuff with maybe 3, 4, 5 different people. And they're really, you know, like facing big giants that they have been there in this space for such a long time. So I think this is one of the things that I like the most about AI.
That's truly inspiring. Thank you. Thank you, Eduardo. That was really great to hear. We're at time. So I just want to say, Eduardo Audax, thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure to speak with you. I would just say that with AI in the cloud, there's no limits, only possibilities. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ian. It was such a long pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the Agents of Data podcast. The podcast is brought to you by intelligent data integration platform Matillion. To discover agentic data engineering, visit matillion.com/mire. Don't forget to subscribe and let us know what you think of everything we discussed over on Matillion's LinkedIn and Instagram.